Probably.
Can you reconstruct the kind of purpose that that was supposed to have had?
The only clear or semi-clear purpose was that as a family group, I felt it was would be much richer to be part of a, not to be isolated, but to be integrated in a larger group, so that you end up by having a bigger family, let's say. And as I was saying, that maybe is what has been translated later into this idea of the tribal, of the village, and so on. And that was part of some kind of evolution. You move from the single into the collective, and that's represented by the interest that they had in architecture and environment. In school, I was involved in houses, and then I got a little more interested in clusters, and then I got interested in villages and towns and cities and so on.
Also, at that stage, you were had become quite interested in the apprentice system, the Italian apprentice system, the bodega.
Yeah, which was idea. In combination with the Frank Lloyd Wright experience.
Which is also an apprentice type of life.
I've never been negative about the academic process. I think it has its own usefulness and its own importance. So I never suggested to anyone that they should not go to school or anything like that. At the same time, I felt that you need to add to that something else, which is the physical involvement in those parts of your profession or of your activity, which are physical in kind. Setting up apprenticeship is a very good place in our culture.
I'm trying to recall some of the early things that you did when you returned to Arizona, and it seems to me that the Luxembourg bridges were a rather important milestone. I think one of the disappointing parts of that experience is the way in which they didn't get adjudicated as part of the competition.
Well, but that was a priori, because when we got the invitation, there were 2 months left, and you were supposed to be coming out with the project, with a contracting firm, with everything ready for construction. So I knew that there was nothing of any possibility as far as construction, but I was interested in ideas, so I did those 4 or 5 sketches.
So what was your purpose in doing the Luxembourg designs?
I had the pleasure of designing, putting down some ideas about bridges, that's all.
It's rather interesting that you should have, with that and with some later studies, been quite involved in designs that seem to satisfy the automobile and wheeled vehicles, whereas more recently you've really become turned off by the automobile.
Now, I'm turned off by the automobile in the city. I'm not turned off in the automobile as a device that takes man from the city somewhere else. Though I can see the price tag involved in it.
For instance, in Arcosanti, there are no accommodations for automobiles.
There will be.
In terms of simply a harbor, simply a place
outside,
to lock them up.
Outside of the building.
I suppose similar to what happens when you arrive at Venice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You put your car in a garage and forget it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel now about your involvement in making bells? I realize that it's your daily bread, but how would you relate that very long-term commitment to something that could be considered a little bit superficial? How do you see making bells with your chief goals in life?
Oh, I think it's good to smart to be active in all at all levels somehow, all time. And if I was picked up and put into even the most comfortable and freeing environment, but I couldn't do anything physically, I would go out of my mind in a few days. So I need the physical involvement. And the bells, now I'm not that much of an involvement, but in fact now I'm selling again because I think we need more money, so I'm trying to come up with a new line to produce more income.
But also you feel the need to have your hands involved.
Yeah. But I enjoy more and more gardening, in a way.
In terms of physical
involvement. And designing for it.
I'm sort of interested in what you might have to say about work. Work is a life activity as opposed to some other way of spending your time.
Well, if your mind ticks, then anything is work in a way. Because supposedly you go up by doing, you know, almost anything. If your mind is totally idle, then no matter how busy you are, you're not working. You're just a busybody. The thing is that, as I was saying, if I had to engage myself only with my mind, then I would really be in bad shape. So I need to be able to move from what you might call the pure speculative to the very physical, and that's why I feel very much the importance of having an environment in which you can integrate those two things. So one minute you are sitting down writing something, the next minute you are moving the hose or trimming a tree or something like that.
But it would be fairly easy to relate that kind of restlessness and ambition with the Protestant work ethic, which supposedly is one of the foundations of the success of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
How do you relate to the Protestant work ethic?
Well, if greed comes in, then I don't relate. And that's not because of a moral decision, because I don't have any inclination, you know, toward accumulating things. It just doesn't interest me. So if the ethics is to be productive, because to be productive is important for man in general, I think I would agree. If this ethic is attached, or is the bandwagon, or is something that brings in this very quiet but very, very powerful greed ethos, then I'm not interested in it.
You've been interviewed many times, too many times.
I haven't learned my lesson yet.
Yes. What are the typical sort of questions that people ask, interviewers ask?
Well, I don't know. I forget things. Well, when they ask about the ecology, the typical question is, you're treating people like bees or like ants. What makes you think that you have the right to do that, for instance?
So
then we go down from there.
But in effect, they are passing judgment in...
Well, it's very difficult to have a person questioning you without this person building the answer in some question.
True. But, what you've suggested is that a typical reaction to everything that you're doing and standing for comes into that kind of understanding of crowding.
Well,
of automating human
beings. One of
my
slogans is that life is in the thick of things. So.
Yes, but thickness doesn't have to be the uniformity of BBs.
No, I don't mean thickness of matter, I mean thickness of events.
Yes, but again, the thickness doesn't necessarily force uniformity.
No. Mm-mm.
And that seems to be part of the message that people aren't getting.
Well, because it's quite naturally when you see a little model or a little sketch, evidently this cannot portray the potentials or the possibility of whatever this little diagram shows. Maybe if this person had in mind a grid of Phoenix, then maybe you could begin to say, well, look at the grid of Phoenix, it's not that portent of great variety. But we accept anything that we are used to. In fact, we make the modus vivendi the stuff of our life, and we said, well, we just improve this and that, and we got it. We cannot very well accept anything else that doesn't belong to this acknowledged, somehow known and predictable thing that we surround ourselves with. That's why it's so difficult to do something which is out of the ordinary. It's frightening. No matter what it is, it's frightening.
Would you see that as being one of the reasons why the architectural profession has not been particularly interested in what you're doing?
Well, the architectural profession should be a little more clever than that, frankly, because the architect should be able to move from the abstraction of an idea or a symbol of an idea into a projection of what this might imply. So I'm very willing to understand the difficulty of the layman. Toward something which is outside of the ordinary. I'm not at all willing to accept that in a professional person.
In terms of your own life and comparing it with a typical architect, you have built very few things.
Almost nothing. Practically nothing.
What does that mean?
Well, it means many things. One thing means that I might have a moment of frustration. But it means also that it would be very foolish to think that the profession of architecture is construction. Or to mean that a person fails because there's a title attached to this person, and the title suggests that unless you build 50,000 tons a year of something, you were not a success story or anything like that. In fact, it's quite evident that architecture involves more than the execution of some ideas. At this point, it involves a theological process.
How do you regard your many unbuilt projects?
As ideas that are sitting there with some merits, but not being developed to the point of concreteness, they are very abstract.
Do you see their value as primarily to yourself in terms of your own evolution?
Oh yeah, if all those things were cancelled from my mind, I would be in bad shape, because they're very much part of my development.
Which of those projects do you think you learned most from? Of the unbuilt things?
They're all unbuilt.
It's probably hard to even separate one study from another.
I wouldn't know.
Still, it has not seemed to be tremendously important to you to publish those studies.
No, I think they are sitting there, and they'll be useful from time to time, or maybe in a little more organized way from now on. I'm really thinking that we have a patrimony there that we should make use of, translated into bags of cement, etc., etc.
You just used the term "we." You're identifying a broader front of people.
Yeah, I didn't mean we the Pope. I meant we the Foundation.
Still, one of the interesting things about the development of your idea is the fact that while there is a team effort, in effect, there have not been any other people who've been associated with these ideas for an extended period of time who have achieved some identity.
And I don't know exactly why that is so. Because I think at this point the concept is pretty clear and can be totally separated from me. Totally.
Yes.
And so I don't know. I know that evidently it would not be easy for me to have a twin person at this point with which I could work, you know, in total resonance. It would have been much easier many years ago.
But alternatively, someone else would bring their own strengths and weaknesses, which could be complementary.
Yeah.
It hasn't been, I mean, that is simply the way things have happened. There hasn't been any program in one direction or another.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that somehow quite normal, though? If there is a strong drive somewhere from somebody, it's not very easy to have another strong drive come in and work in tandem. It's not that it's impossible, but it's not the most normal thing to happen.
How do you see yourself in relationship to the giants of the early part of the 20th century in architectural terms? How do you see what you're doing with people such as Le Corbusier?
I don't know. Evidently their physical production is enormously more substantial than mine. So from that point of view, it would be hard for me to think of being there with them.
But what about the world of ideas?
Well, I think in that world, I think I have something very important.
And that you
as important as anyone.
So that you have grown on and grown out of some of their leadership.
Oh, I think so, definitely. And I have so little interest now in architecture as such, in the sense of seeing what this architect does or that architect does. The last thing I'm interested in opening is an architectural magazine, which in a way it's bad, but I really don't have any interest for reading about architecture. You know.
So what sort of magazines do you open?
Oh, Time Magazine.
Time.
The Bible.
Do you miss Life Magazine?
No, not very much. what's left of it.
And and what is it on TV that? Is most captivating.
Well, as an Italian, anything that moves on the screen is very
hypnotic.
Hypnotic.
I think you get a great deal out of the documentaries, don't you?
Oh, I would never agree with anyone that TV is useless or is evil or anything like that. I'm very glad it exists. And in fact, for me personally, I don't read any newspapers, so that's where I get my news. My daily ration of contemporary events.
Earlier you used a term frugality in a way of describing how you live. Do you really see that as being an appealing way for other people in the United States to live?
I'm just finishing a paper about it.
And what what does it say?
Well, it says that for one thing, it says that mediocrity and frugality are antithetic, and I'm trying to explain it why. I don't know if I can now. I mean, without the paper. Then I'm saying that at this point, it seems to be the only thing that would really fit the totality of mankind. And I'm saying that the frugal condition, which is a chosen condition, is not an imposed condition. It's the condition where you are more alert and more ready to do things and willing to attempt things.
From a cultural point of view, I suppose we could find a precedent, though, for both points of view. There are cultures that have reached very high plateaus based on frugality, very modest means.
Mm-hmm.
But alternatively, one can identify some very strong results from highly consumptive situations.
Yeah, the question there was always that this consumption was conspicuous for a minority, but it was based on almost in squalor or wretchedness for the majority. So the leisure classes in the past were based on the toil and the labor of the masses. Now this is not necessarily so anymore, but still.
You don't see that as being appropriate.
Well, evidently there must be a better way of developing your brain than being a parasite of most of mankind.
So, in effect, you would advocate a pretty strong ethic in terms of lifestyle.
I would guess so. That's why I have to get this through the people that are working with me in a more constant way than just the 6 weeks, so that we are clear about a certain number of things.
Can you describe how frugality might affect, let's say, one's diet?
I think that you can manage your feeding in a pretty simple way without giving up the pleasure of eating at all. But naturally, it depends so much on your background and also on your demands of your body. And naturally, when you're young, you react to gulp a certain amount of energy that you don't need any longer when you're not any young anymore. But if you go into a supermarket, you are somehow dismayed by the double thing. There's so much but the, though there is so much, there is so little as far as real quality, that immediately you are struck by some kind of wastefulness that we should be able to get rid of. I don't know, you've been in some of the European countries or Greece, and you know how much you can do with just about nothing, really nothing, three or four things that you have the skill of putting them together in the right way, and you get an incredible thing. And then you enter into a 2-acre supermarket and you wonder.
In effect, this is an application of aesthetogenesis on another level.
Yeah, which is the level where everyone not only has the right to be, but anyone should try to develop, because that's the art of living, which is to make your life into an aesthetic process, into a graceful process. And you can do it with very limited amount of anything.
Just following that idea, maybe we don't need architecture.
No, I'm not in for that, because architecture is an intermediary that it's absolutely essential. Not architecture as maybe the architect being, you know, the God that makes decision, but as that kind of in the environment which connects you to the raw nature, or to nature as such. Whenever you have two persons, you have two persons plus an institution between those two persons. And this institution, it's as necessary as the two persons. And this institution can be as simple as a glass with some wine, or a plate with some bread, but it can become as complex as a library, as a movie theater, as a meeting place, as anything, as the city. So this is necessary.
So the frugality is not in the concept of frugality is not the elimination of means, but it's in the selective and creative
the leanness of the means and the substance of them. Because otherwise frugality would mean that you slowly go back to being a naked ape, even forgetting that you cannot have 10 billions of naked apes. You could have only a few millions of naked apes. They couldn't survive in any other way.
So you see frugality as being much more than an expedient.
Absolutely. It's a certain condition, say a certain condition of grace where you can really begin to perform if there is something in you that allows you to perform. So it's a privilege, it's not a coercion, it's not a condition of a handicap or an inferior condition. It's an optimum position for action.
Some people have suggested that you and your life have somewhat withdrawn from the real life. How do you feel about how you've withdrawn?
I don't have a very exciting life, if you know by excitement you mean I don't know what. I have a very routine life, and in many ways.
But if you're hoping to be able to provide some universal directions, let's say, mm-hmm. Maybe you should be more in the thick of things, to use your quotation.
No, I'm trying to build a thickness which I believe I can believe in.
So that you really see as a primary goal.
Well, yeah, we are not in the desert or up country because we want to get away from it. We want to establish it there with some characteristics, frugality being one. The other one being being conscious that there are very fundamental problems that we have to face. And again, to make the list, energy, non-integrity in the sense of segregation, the enormous amount of materials and gadgetries and hardware that we seem to be convincing ourselves they are necessary, indispensable, the pollution problem, etc., population. As I was saying, if those bells are not constantly ringing, it's very easy to go into some kind of a binge, which has a dead end. And this doesn't mean that I think we are successful in what we are doing, but we are attempting to do something in those directions.
What do you see as your life goal? Probably it changes
mm-hmm.
daily or yearly, but where you are at the moment, what do you see the goal of you having lived?
Well, to introduce a certain understanding of a discipline that life needs in order to find freedom. Or at least find a beginning of a freedom.
And the freedom?
The freedom means that that within an immense contest of non-living, life is able to affirm itself and to move forward and further into transforming the non-living into the living.
So within this scheme of things, choice is very important.
Yeah, as a discrimination for this process.
Do you have anything more to say?
It's going to be nap time.
I think I'm pretty well wiped out.
The question that I'd asked at the end of the last session is one that I really wish we could pursue, but I don't know.
Oh, about the profession?
Well, the profession and the... you know, the ordinary person. It seems to me that environment is something that everybody has to deal with. Somehow or other, it requires professional expertise, which obviously, just by definition, everybody doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like we're in a absolute bind when you begin to look at the global kind of responsibilities. It seems like architects are in a very controversial kind of position.
Yeah, well, as you were saying, there are two ways of looking at it, from the inside and from the outside. From both directions, we should realize that we have to trust. We need, if we don't base life on trust, we are in for a degrading kind of constant, you know, bleeding. If I don't feel well, I'm not going to the butcher or to the to real estate, man, I'm going to the doctor. If I need a garment, I'm not going to the priest or to the psychiatrist, I'm going to the tailor. So I have to trust in every act in which I'm involved, I have to trust in the expertise of someone else. And if I cannot do that, then I'm in for disaster. I'm just going to kill myself through doubt, through envy, through all sorts of ugly and not very constructive things. So we must delegate to other people and to other institutions things which are going to transform our lives. And hopefully there is some expertise here and there that makes the doctor to know a little more than the butcher, and the tailor know a little more about garments than the pharmacist. And so, as an architect, we have to be worthy of this trust. And the business of being creative, it's most of the time the business of being selective. That's why education is so important, because we have to try to become more selective by elevating the quality of the choices that we make through our own education. But what we enjoy most of the time is not the fact that we create something. What we enjoy most of the time is the fact that we have options and we make a choices which we feel are right. So again, if I had to buy a pair of shoes, I'm not going to make a pair of shoes. No, I used to make them for myself, but they were sandals. But you go in and from the selection that presented to you, you pick out the pair of shoes that you identify with. So this is a delegation, this is vicariousness, and sometimes you bring in mimesis, you copy. You see something which attacks you, and you say you are attacked so much that you want to make something which is similar to it. So you copy with a little variations, and you come out with something that you feel you made yourself. It's original with you. But most of the time, it's a copy of something that you enjoyed seeing or feeling or experiencing. And we should have that enough humility to understand that that's most of what we do and enjoy. Be vicarious, doing act of mimesis, and trusting.
That's a pretty strong case for professionals.
Well, both ways. It indicates the responsibility of them, and also the fact that they should be trusted. Because if you don't, if nobody trusts anybody else, then it's everybody for oneself.
Does anyone here have any questions they'd like to pose? Yes.
I'd like to ask you about what you mentioned before. We were talking about achieving the ability for creativity, and the question of mediocrity. How do you know whether you're being mediocre or not?
That's a good question, and I don't know. It seems to me that when you tend to perform in a way which is not really making you feel better, but it might be able to fit you in a certain frame which goes for respectability, for instance, at that point you have to be very careful, because that's where mediocrity might creep in. In other words, if you are really honest with yourself, then I think you cannot be mediocre. But if you begin to act for the sake of things that you really don't believe in, but you feel that it's opportune to stick with, then you fall into the condition of mediocrity. So you can be terribly humble, terribly ignorant in many ways, and what you might call ungifted, and never be mediocre. Or you can be very gifted, very fortunate, and have a certain drive and be terribly mediocre. Because in a way you are, there is malice, there is hypocrisy, and opportunism involved in what you do. And naturally, we are all prey of those things, so we are all mediocre in many, many of the things we do. The point is to be able to get off now and then and really be able to see ourselves and try to do something about it. And the other thing is that we do so many things with our lives that in some fields we cannot escape a certain level of mediocrity. And those are the fields where we should accept the judgment or the guidance of someone else. Because we might excel in one direction and then need terribly guidance in many other directions. The first part of the question. The first part of the question I forgot. Oh, you had something about creativity and.
Well, I was just trying to question the frame of reference, where it occurred in the interview.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? Yes.
You said that we have to depend on the expertise of some other people, otherwise we're dead. And I'd like to know if you've always felt this way, and if that applies to a whole spectrum of fields, or is there some fields that we do have to depend on and others we can manage by ourselves?
Well, we all tend to specialize somehow. So when we specialize in a certain direction, that's where we tend to interrogate ourselves when we need expertise. So if I'm a doctor and I don't feel well, I might investigate through my knowledge what the trouble might be with me, or if I'm an architect and I have a problem or environmental kind, I might get my expertise out and try to get answers. But evidently we cannot be expert in every field. So we need help desperately, most of the time.
Have you always felt this dependence on the rest of
you? You don't have to consciously be aware of that, but if you examine your existential posture, you find out that you're utterly dependent constantly from everybody else. So the norm is that you are a dependent animal. The exception is that now and then you are able to offer to society or to life something that might make you a giver.
Did you see the special the other day on Iron Man?
I missed it the other day, and I they had it before, and I missed the first part.
Well, maybe I can explain what I'm thinking about. It was a pretty elementary presentation, but something that they indicated through this picturing of the circumstances was that once the ape-like creature descended from the trees to the ground, to the horizontal plane, and began to travel and to observe other animals and to